and we'll call the Senate Transportation Committee to order as well. And I know it's awfully warm in here. We'll try to move through our agenda as quickly as we can.
So I have the gavel over here, so I'll get started, and unless someone says that he wants it back. we'll go ahead and start today with the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1080, and Tom McClellan and Jack Evans will come up. My understanding is we have someone from LC.
Chair Metzger, Chair Beyer, committee members, Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation, and with me is Tom McClellan, D&D Administrator. We're here today to give you an update on Senate Bill 1080, and what I'm going to do is give you a brief background, talk about some specific issues, some problems we've been dealing with, and then tell you about how we're going to fix those. So Senate Bill 1080 was implemented a couple of months ago on July 1st. It applies to first-time renewal or replacement driver's licenses and instruction permits or ID cards. And the three changes that the bill brought about were the requirement for documentation for legal presence in the U.S., documentation of your Social Security number, and documentation of full legal name. These requirements are added to existing requirements, which have been always in place for an individual to prove identity, date of birth, and origin of residence. The bill also authorizes a 90-day applicant temporary permit that will allow people to who already have that proof of identity and residence, and date of birth to sign a statement that they're certifying they're lawfully present in the United States, and that this gives them an additional 90 days to work on some of that documentation, and there's a provision for an extension. By administrative rule, DMV adopts the list of documents that will be accepted, and the remaining parts of Senate Bill 1080 will be phased in 2009 and 2010. In 2009, we'll begin with the electronic verification through the Department of Homeland Security of immigration documents. That'll become available then. And then by 2010, we'll have in place the programming necessary to issue those short-term driver licenses that are tied to an individual's length of stay. So as far as how has this impacted customers, which is the issue that I know you've been hearing a lot about, and as we have as well. This, as I mentioned, applies to everyone in Oregon, and that is regardless of how long you've been here or how long you've had an Oregon driver's license, it applies to everybody. And this is, I will start out by saying, the most extensive, far-reaching restriction on driver's license requirements the DMV has gone through in such a short period of time ever. So we've found some things out and learned some things. Customers have expressed their irritation to us. Some of them, regardless of how well we publicize this, and we did have an extensive communications campaign, some of them were either unaware of the requirements or came in and thought that the requirements didn't apply to them because they've been in the country for a long time or they've had an Oregon driver's license for a long time. That's not the case. As a result, they have to go home and get the appropriate documents, or they have to order them from the appropriate agency, and this caused a considerable amount of frustration. The documents that DMV is requiring, are essentially government-issued documents. These are secure documents or documents that have been issued by a county that have been filed with that county, and this applies to things like birth certificates and marriage licenses. So that's been a source of frustration for folks. The biggest problem by far of all these of the issues and the new requirements has been the requirement to document full legal name. And that has been an issue that has hit women particularly hard because of the name-changing conventions in our country. So the way the rules initially were, and I'm going to be telling you a good story about how we're going to fix this, but the initial way this was handled was that if somebody showed up with a legal presence document and that with a name on it that was different than their current name and the name they wanted to portray on their driver's license, and typically this involves marriage, they would have to show linking documents that link their current name with the name on their legal presence document. That could involve multiple documents. If an individual had been married several times and divorced, theoretically you could go through marriage licenses and divorce decrees till you get back linking current name to the name that's on in that example on the birth certificate. That has caused a considerable amount of frustration. Also, individuals that DMV has run into, a lot of individuals who just never legally changed their name. And that might be a situation where someone was adopted and they just began to assume their adoptive parent's name or a step-parent. Kids take on the step-parent's name but never went through and did that legally and had no documents to show it. So what's DMV going to do about all this? How are we going to resolve these problems? And let me stress that the resolution that we're going to describe to you here doesn't involve legal presence. This involves the legal name issue. This doesn't touch the rigor of the legal presence, which is at the core of Senate Bill 1080. So this afternoon, Tom spoke before the Oregon Transportation Committee, and they adopted new rules. And these changes that we'll describe are going to effect on the 15th of September. Number one, DMV is going to be, for full legal name documentation, they're going to be greatly expanding the list of documents that they'll be accepting. And that essentially will be the list of documents that are currently in the identity documents in rule with DMV. And those are things like your driver's license, military documents, tribal IDs, Canadian birth certificate, out-of-state driver's licenses, concealed weapons permits. There's a whole list of identity documents that are already in rule. DMV will be accepting those for proof of legal name. In addition, the method in which they make the connection between legal presence and legal name documents will be made much more flexible in that an individual may have the same surname on both documents, which is fine, but if they don't, but both documents contain a common birth date, place of birth, and parent's name, some of these things, DMV will accept these since those are reasonable and are adequate to prove full legal name. So, for example, you could have the example in the testimony here is Sally Ann Jones, who has on her driver's license the name Sally Jones. On her birth certificate is Sally Ann Smith. But both those documents contain the birth date and the first name. And that is adequate to make that connection for full legal name purposes, and DMV is going to go with that. Where in the past, there may have been a situation where Sally would have had to produce marriage licenses, and had she been had multiple marriages, produced divorce decrees and some of these. So this is going to solve probably 90% or a significant number of the issues we've been seeing. The DMV is also doing some other things that will be more flexible, and this is based on their experience. These are some things that, with the volume of individuals they deal with, weren't anticipated but are going to be modified. One of them is to allow an individual in the full legal name situation to use any combination of names as long as they appear on their lawful presence, identity, and name change documents. So there's an example of someone from India, and the convention there evidently is for the woman to use the husband's last name as her middle name and then retain her maiden name without accepting his last name. So those are the kinds of things that DMV is being flexible and is going to be able to accommodate. The other thing is if someone has, for example, on their passport a truncated name, the passports only allow, like, I think it's like 29 spaces. This will allow, if your first name has been truncated and your middle name has been reduced to a middle initial, DMV will allow a person just to tell them what's your full first name and what's your full middle name and accept that verbal verification. So that should take care of a vast number of problems we're seeing. In addition to that, DMV is going to continue its communication program, updating its website, responding to the media. The renewal notices that are sent out to folks will contain this information. There'll be brochures and posters and continue to have handouts. The customer assistance program is the ombudsman position that was I mentioned in statute. DMV is currently hiring that position. They have trained a staff of customer care unit personnel that have learned this stuff in and out and have provided great assistance. The ombudsman is being hired, is not on board. The individual that has been fulfilling that role is Diane Reeves, who's a customer service manager at DMV, and she's been doing a remarkable job shepherding folks through this process. The review process itself is going to be made more flexible so that if there are gray areas that are presented to field staff, where appropriate, field staff will elevate that to supervisory and management staff, so there will be a different set of eyes on it. So somebody, for example, is born at home, has no birth document because of that situation, but they've got a wealth of other documentation. Rather than turning that person away, that'll be elevated, and other folks will bring in their judgment, and that should solve a significant number of problems as well. And then we'll continue with the applicant temporary permits, which if you're working on this documentation, you will, and you can certify you're legally present in the United States and you have your identity documents and some of the other requirements, then you'll be allowed to have a 90-day permit that allow you to drive, to continue to drive while you're working on the documentation. So far, DMV has issued 5,200 of these things to assist people through the process. I suspect that there will be less of a need for those now since DMV has so greatly opened up the process. So again, in conclusion, let me just say that this is a very dramatic change that DMV has gone through. DMV recognizes the frustration that people have experienced and has responded to that. The Oregon Transportation Commission has made changes to the rules that will go into effect on the 15th of September regarding this full legal name issue. And we expect that we'll see about 90% of our problems that individuals experience go away, and yet we'll still maintain the core essence of Senate Bill 1080, which is legal presence. So with that, I will open it up to questions that you might have for Tom and I.
Yes, you did mention our residency. I just renewed my driver's license, and I had all the documents I thought I needed, and then they said, prove that I lived where I lived. I've been there 39 years. But I had to go really grab some things in a hurry that could prove that I lived where I lived. Has that not been a problem for people?
Senator Berger, that we have some people that have problems with that. It's truly the case, but it's been around a long time, that requirement to prove that you have a residence here in Oregon to be eligible to get an Oregon driver's license. And for people who have things mailed to their home address, it's pretty easy. Those with a P.O. box, it's a little tougher because they may not have something that is a solid document. We have a pretty long list of documents. If you've gone through this, you've probably looked at that list of documents, but options that people have to prove that they actually live here in Oregon. That is a statutory requirement that they must meet there.
Well, I was so concerned with obeying the new rules that when I got there, I had to really try to remember what I had that would prove that I lived at that particular, and I have a delivery to my residence, not a P.O. box.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jack, first of all, I just want to thank you. Every call from my constituents has been answered by DMV in a very prompt and efficient manner, and I greatly appreciate the help that DMV has provided to my constituents. I have a question about the temporary permits. How does the charge for that work? Is an Oregon driver charged anything extra to get the temporary permit and then get the driver's license, or is it all within the same fee?
Chair Metzger, Chair Beyer, Representative Buckley, it's my understanding that that's all subsumed under that same fee.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Senator Stark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the number of effective is temporary permit. So can I just make an assumption that if 4.3% of your total are having to get the temporaries, that over 95% of the folks that walk in the door are able to accomplish the process and get to walk out of there eventually with a driver's license without too much hassle?
Senator, Chair Metzger, Chair Beyer, Senator Starr, yes, that's my understanding. There's a, you know, that's a big number, the 4.3%, that's too big. But people do go in, take care of business, and it may take a visit to go back home and get the required documentation, which we've heard about as well, but they don't need any 90-day temporary. They can transact their business in the same day.
Senator Starr, another factor to consider there is if a person comes in 2 months before, 6 weeks before their license expires, they may leave the office because they don't have the documents, but they won't need the applicant temporary because their license hasn't expired yet. So to assume that 95% of people are getting it on the first trip is probably not a good assumption. Because of the difficulty in having the right documents the first time you walk in the door, some are able to leave, get the document that same day, even if they're in the county seat, they may be able to get the document that they needed and just come right back that same day or a few days later. So it's just worth pointing that out.
I have kind of a follow-up question on this temporary permit, and it may be too soon for you to be able to answer this, but if you are issuing the temporary permits to 5,200 people, how many are actually following through and getting their permit? I mean, getting their license. Are a lot of those people falling off?
Chair Beyer, I have not seen any statistics yet to really analyze that. It's been in place for 2 months. I'm curious to see how many people actually get their license at the end. I'm also interested in how long it takes them. If they're getting their license in 30 days or if it's actually taking up to 90 days for people to get that issued to them. I have not seen any data yet on that.
And I'm very curious about that too, so as this moves on.
We can share that with committee staff if you'd like.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Madam Chair. I've, like all of us, I've gotten a number of contacts from constituents, generally women, generally older. Some of them, as old as I am. And always it's a matter of either several marriages and they didn't keep the documentation of the divorces and the marriages and they lost all of that and couldn't find it, or some kind of an adoption situation. You mentioned both of those. From now on, now, September 15th, you said you'll put these new rules into effect and you'll have your ombudsman on board by that time. So from now on, if I get additional, I know I will, calls from people like this, I can tell them that the rules are changing and suggest that they call the office of the ombudsman.
Chair Metzger, Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe, yes, and you can always just direct them to me and I can take care of that for them. That problem that you described should be resolved. But there's still that the Ombudsman's office is on board to help people sort of navigate the process and answer specific situations.
There's some very, very, very frustrated people out there. It's frustrating for me when I can't help them. I can fix it. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you. I just have a quick comment, and I think that all of us probably knew that we were going to have a lot of frustrated people when we pass this legislation, and I appreciate the efforts you're making to try to help this along as painlessly as possible as we move forward. So thank you. Gavel from me. I'm going to close that public information hearing and open informational hearing on the vessel traffic information system. And I have a Jim Townley and Captain Paul Amos. And I must have a third person that I don't have a name.
Actually, Madam Chair, we'll take care of this.
Oh,
we
good.
Have five people that
okay.
are willing to talk on this topic. And, as soon as we figure out the technology, we're ready to come up.
Chairman Beyer, distinguished members of the Senate and House Transportation Committee, I'm Jim Townley, Executive Director of the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association. It's a genuine pleasure to be here today and give this briefing, because what it really amounts to is a story, and it's the kind of story that makes all of us proud to be citizens of Oregon and residents of the Pacific Northwest. I think you're going to enjoy what you see. The main reason why we wish to give this presentation, and I want to say it's we, let's look at the theme for a moment. We brought five members, including myself, here, who have actually experienced and made many of the decisions creating the capabilities and possibilities that we're going to describe to you today. And you've already mentioned the president of the River Pilots, Paul Amos. We also have Rob Rich here from Shaver Transportation Towing. I also want to point out this is Phil Brotherton, because he's the immediate past chair of the Columbia Steamship Operators Association on the board of directors. And Randy Click, who's currently vice president of the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association. We're going to cover these topics with the anticipation that as various constituents and other interested parties come to the various transportation committees with proposals during the legislative session, you're at least aware of what's been going on with the transportation industry right here in the state of Oregon and in the Columbia Snake system, and possibly on occasion have an aha moment that would lead to, my goodness, if we were to get these people that are talking with us and making this proposal to talk to the folks that gave this briefing today, we might actually get some synergies that are good for the state and the region.
Mr. Chair, what kind of proposals?
Oh. Just the normal course of business, Madam Senator, that you would, in the course of doing legislative work, might come your way. We have nothing specific. I don't know enough about, honestly, the type of proposals that are put before the transportation committees. We just want you to be aware of what we're doing. And if it makes sense to you in the future that somebody is doing something that seems to be related to the technologies and the information system and information sharing systems we're about to describe, you'll know who to call. If it doesn't, it doesn't. You're welcome. Who are we? The Columbia River Steamship Operators Association has been around for 86 years. We had a hand in establishing the Pacific Northwest Waterway Association, which was the organization back in the Inland Empire days that put the locks and dams in place on the Columbia Snake system. You see, we're in our mission statement. I want you to look at both the mission and the purpose just briefly to show that while lobbying is one of the things we do, it's really not the main reason that we're in business. Our goal is to try and make this region more and more interesting and cost competitive and safe and secure and remove uncertainties with moving cargo, that we can attract more shippers and more shipowner and operators into our system. Bottom line, revenue, tonnage, jobs. Those are the three things we pay a lot of attention to. And we do this in the purpose statement you see there by working as closely as we can with various government agencies, both on the executive side, legislative side, and with just about any stakeholder, including Oregon Farm Bureau, just as an example. A lot of the folks out in eastern Oregon, we're in touch with all kinds of possibilities and things out there. We're looking at the whole transportation corridor from Lewiston, Idaho, to Astoria, and then, of course, all the connecting ports around the world. I'm going to have Paul Amos now talk about the river pilots for a few minutes, who are our partners in this endeavor on the private sector side.
Right. Yes, good afternoon. My name is Paul Amos. I'm the president of the Columbia River Pilots. The river pilots, we're an association of 45 professional mariners. We take the ships from Astoria to Portland, Vancouver ports, and from Portland, Vancouver to Astoria. The Columbia River bar pilots bring them from sea into Astoria. We get on a ship in Astoria and take them up and down the river and turn them back over to the bar as they depart through Astoria. It's our responsibility to protect the public environment, the public safety and environment of the river system. And we are licensed by the state of Oregon. The Oregon State Board of Maritime Pilots oversees our training programs and basically regulates how we operate. And they've been established since 1847, so it's been over 150 years in business with us. This is just a photograph of our office in Portland, Oregon. We also have offices in Astoria where we make the change over to the bar pilots down there, and we have quarters down there where we spend the night or the day waiting for the next ship to come in.
Okay, I want to review a couple things about the commerce in general just to set the context, because we're not going to look at every single thing on there, but there's a few things that are really worth highlighting. The 40,000 jobs. There we go. And $16 billion in cargo. And the other thing with respect to the $15 to $20 million worth of local revenue just from passenger vessel operations here in the Columbia system as well. The fact that we're number one in a great many things is worthy of note, both with respect to the United States and West Coast. What isn't showing up there is that we are the number two grain export gateway for the United States, as well as number four in agricultural products. So there's an awful lot of value in what we move by water through the Columbia Snake system. What we're going to talk about is these three topics. And this is where the story, I hope, will get very interesting for you, because many of you are going to remember some of the experiences from, it's one of those things, you never forget where you were when it happened. Now, while we all hate acronyms, I'm going to have to at least explain two of them that we're not going to talk much about in the presentation, but we will be referring to the AIS and the Commerce Information Action Center. AIS is a technical term internationally recognized for transponders that all ships in the United States are required, or all ships in the world are required to have on board as of well, long before 2008. That'll make more sense in a few moments when we get into the story. But all ships have them. Think of the transponders as very similar to what aircraft have on board them. You know where they are, you know their course, their speed, you know their name, the number. And with respect to the AI system, we know a lot more information about the ships as well. The Commerce Information Action Center, all I will say on that is that it was a solution that the private sector in our region came up with to put a single window of access to all private sector for public agencies, public emergency and law enforcement people, and folks like yourself. We think that you should have one number to call, and that number should be on everybody's Rolodex, and think of it possibly like you would use a 911 number. But if you had a problem or an issue, this one location would, in fact, be helpful to you. Yes, Senator. Sure.
I'm not quite sure I understand what that means if I have a problem. The ship runs aground, if my ship is late to take my cargo out, what exactly does that number do?
That number would be very, very useful if we had, let's say, an incident in the Columbia River that blocked the channel, or if we had a flood or an earthquake or a volcano erupt, or if we had extremely low water situations where navigation couldn't be safely done. It's going to have a ripple effect up and down supply chains.
Follow, Mr. Chair. So someone calls that, and then a notice to mariners goes out, or you call 911, or what happens?
All of the professionals in the supply chain is affected, and those that are peripherally affected are notified. The ones that are directly affected are actually brought together in ability to make decisions and to share what the private sector is doing with public sector officials who are also doing their response operations.
So an emergency operations center would be open somewhere if there was a significant incident on the river, a ship went aground or something significant happened?
Yes.
Where is this housed?
Well, it would be at the best location for communication that suits each specific incident. The system we built is virtual. which means it can be anywhere. It can be everybody that needs to be on it can be operating on a laptop out of a hotel room or out of their home office if they wish.
Physically, where does the phone number for that answer right now?
At the moment, the phone number is down at the RMSC, or it's my phone number, honestly. So if you were on after hours to call my cell phone, which is 503-939-7854, that's the number that we're using until we can get this center more formally established.
One last one. Get the center more formally established. What's that mean?
It means we have a variety of ways of contacting us right now. Our vision is to get to this one number. We're not there yet. This has been a beta test, as you'll see when we get into the presentation, Madam Senator.
So what's your relationship with RMSC that I understand spent $800,000 and we're using your cell phone?
I'm not sure of what the question is.
We have one phone number to contact for emergencies on the river, and it's your cell phone.
Oh, no. You could call anybody. Take our business card. You can call any of us, and we will get in touch. Just right at this point, the best number that we have and that we've used to the last winter storms was my cell phone number, because I volunteered it, because I'm executive director of the steamship operators. That was the only reason.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you for your questions. The other acronyms will become a little more as we get into the presentation.
Yeah, we just asked that RMCAD.
It means Regional Maritime Security Coalition, and we will be explaining that very soon there. Senator Starr. This is, everybody think about what was happening where you lived at the time of flood, because this is really where it all started. And you can see Terminal 6, and you can see what the flood stages were. We're talking 10 or 11 feet over flood stages, so I think it's no surprise to anybody this is a very significant event. Now, the river pilots were aware of this automated information system that I described coming down, and they saw its capabilities because it shows where the ships are relative to GPS, geographic positioning system. And if we had that in the place during the flood, there would never have been any question about the ability to safely navigate a ship up and down the channel. After all, you've got 10 extra feet or over flood stage underneath the keels of all the ships over here. The problem we had is the Coast Guard said they were going to close the river for 2 weeks because all the aids to navigation had been swept out by the debris, the logs and things that came rolling down that mighty river. And our problem with that is the last time the river was ever closed for 2 weeks was when Mount St. Helens blew. And according to a study that the Port of Portland did, I believe in about 1999 or 2000, it took 10 years to recover the amount of commerce we lost to competing ports. Because other ports with whom we compete were quick to say, you know, if you do business with us, you're not going to have to deal with 100 miles of river that might be blocked by another volcano eruption. It takes a while to get the business back. So we knew that a two-week closure was going to have a devastating impact, and we couldn't live with that. So we got together with the river pilots and other members of the industry and developed some alternatives that could safely move commerce down the river. We didn't have the DTIS as yet. But we had other alternatives we could use, and we needed to demonstrate that to the Coast Guard. So we went down and made a presentation to the Coast Guard. Long story short, in less than 36 hours, the river was back up to full operation with the full confidence of the Coast Guard and the pilots that we could move ships safely. So we learned something from that. We learned that if we come together with an industry, come up with creative, proactive solutions, and then go down to the federal agencies and make presentations, they were actually happy to have us do that, rather than what was more traditional, was wait for them to make some decisions and then we'd react to it. So we learned some things from that. Okay. Took us a couple of years, to work out how we were going to pay for this. We had to get the folks that I represent in a position that they would vote to put a tax on a fee on their own ships in order to come up with the money necessary to put these towers in place. And we decided to take go a little bit forward, stick our heads up, take a look around, plow a little bit further forward, stick our heads up, look around. What I'm getting at there is when we put the system together, we honestly thought we were going to need 5 towers to make this work, and we only had enough money for one. To our surprise, when we put the one tower up, the coverage was fantastic. So we've been operating on one tower up to this point, with the second one going in very, very shortly, because we've raised money to pay for that too, and the one we're putting in will be out in that story, which will give us a much further reach out to the ocean, and it will give us coverage and some blind spots and a backup tower if anything were to happen to the one we have. Paul Lehman shortly is going to talk about that tower. We contracted with the Volpe Center, federal agency. This is another part of our partnership. They're located in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they're an arm of the Department of Transportation Research System Development. They'd already done two studies for the Coast Guard, and were honest enough to come out and say that a vessel traffic service, which again Paul Amos is going to talk about in a few more, in a little more detail in a minute, was not cost effective, was not cost feasible in the Columbia River. What we want is a VTIS, so you're going to see a subtle difference, and Paul will describe the difference, because what our system is a vessel traffic information system, not a vessel traffic service. But they'd had all that experience. They'd also designed the system for some pretty influential waterways in our backyard, and we were going to get the benefit of all of that immediately. And in fact, our system was going to be better than the St. Lawrence Seaway or the Panama Canal because we were building on that. And while at the time we contracted WOLP in August of 2001, we didn't see a value to the security aspects of it then. They also got the contract with the U.S. Navy for the USS Cole. So there were certain encryption capabilities available in the system that we wound up purchasing. Well, if you want to talk about this for a few moments, this is
sure.
Wanted to show you why we wanted to get this particular capability.
And we'll go into more detail about what you see here is a...
Just for the record, just identify yourself again.
Oh, excuse me. Paul Amos with Columbia River Pilots. What you see here is the length of the river from sea to Portland, Oregon, so you can see the location of all the vessels in the system. And that's what we wanted to do to monitor our traffic, because the geographic nature of the mountains, terrain, typically a vessel traffic system does this by radar, but we have a narrow channel. It's just not physically possible and hugely expensive. So we use the technology available with AIS and use the transponders on the ship to identify their location and a lot of other information about it. The one thing that the program Volpe had to offer, it had everything we wanted except one feature. We have a 40-foot channel. We're deepening to 43 now, as you know. And a 40-foot channel, we'll take ships out of here with a 40-foot draft. So we operate close proximity to the bottom, and we rely on the Corps of Engineers heavily for their current surveys. They're always surveying the river somewhere all the time. We constantly get updated information. We needed a system that would display those current Corps of Engineers soundings. Volpe didn't have that capability through the persistence of one of our pilots who got together with the Corps of Engineers and worked with Volpe. They found a way to make it possible. So we now have the ability to go to the Corps of Engineers website. This program we have will go there with the push of one button. It goes to the Corps website, download the most recent information they have, sometimes as recent as 3 or 4 days, and loads it on the laptop so we can see. The red lines you see are the 40-foot contour lines. It's 40 feet or less. The rest of it, you can assume, is more than 40 feet. But you'll see later, as we get in closer, you can see the exact depths of the river.
What was interesting here is the fact, Jim Townley, Columbia River Steamship Operators Association, what was interesting was Volpe thought this was going to be an expensive proposition that they'd have to add to their system. We brought a particular pilot that had already done the work, popped open the computer, their jaws hit the table. They said, wow. Could we use that in other places of the country? Would you mind giving us the software? That was the beginning of a beautiful partnership. Volpe, in essence, has continued to do work, and we've continued to take their technologies and adapt them for very operational reasons that have value to the private sector, and they can take it and use it in other parts of the country, which we have no problem with. It makes the whole system more efficient. So it's sort of brought our area into beta test mode for Volpe and other federal agencies, a capability, which is one of the several that we're going to talk about as the briefing continues, that we're exploiting to the benefit of the region. I might also mention that under the old system, it took months for the pilots, each pilot, to actually find out where the contours were, because they'd meet once a month with whatever available was. They'd lay the charts out on the table. Now you're talking a period of days, weeks, at the most, when the most recent information is available to everybody that's got a laptop. Now, we're going to talk about the 2000 and 2001 low water emergencies right now. And I want to set the tone just in case memory has faded a little bit for some of you. But in 2001, we'd had a terrible low water situation in 2000. And the reason that's bad is because ships contract to load a sufficient amount of, let's say, wheat, that they get down to 40 feet. And, of course, every extra inch is worth tens of thousands of dollars. Feet, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars for an inch on a vessel. And if you've got a sand wave that reduces the depth under keel to 39 or 38 feet, that ship can't load. It either has to stay there until the tidal differences or water spillage through Bonneville gets it up to where it can safely come in and out of our river, or it leaves with less. In either case, lawsuits are always possible. You're giving competitors something to complain about on our river. We found that it was even worse in 2001. And I just wanted to point out that, if, as you may recall, back in 2001, 2002, and into 2003, it was Oregon and Washington that were leading the nation with respect to the recession impact on our jobs. We were 49 and 50, and it was either, we were there 50 or 49 for month after month after month. It was just a terrible situation. And 25%, as I say, of our ship volume had gone down. That's quite significant. Many of you have probably seen that in the definition of insanity before. And we knew that the VTIS was going to be helpful to us in a low water. But there was one other thing that we really wanted to capitalize on, and that was the information sharing part. Back to the flood of 96, it was a sharing of information that got the Coast Guard into making decisions that were helpful to us. Once again, the ship operators and the river pilots went down to the Coast Guard and proposed the creation of an information sharing committee. This particular committee was made up of a few of the folks you see there, plus a whole lot more. And they were able to put forecasts out that were extremely accurate. They were talking with Bonneville about how much power was going to be dumped on which days of the week. And what we're trying to do is get just different inches of additional water underneath the keels of the ships so that we could maximize the loads that were taken out. What this did is it created a really favorable image for us all around the world, because we were putting out information that was truthful, and it wasn't with a smiley face on it. But people could contract to the depth, or they could make the choice ahead of time that, okay, we'll just leave our ships there a couple extra days until we get favorable sailing conditions. My parents live in Ohio, 3 hours time difference. At 6:10, 6:15 in the morning, I got a phone call, turn on your television, and I saw the same horror that you all witnessed. What was different in our situation was we didn't know whether this was going to be the end of it. Was this the opening bell of something much, much worse? We had no idea. So we had to do the prudent thing, and that was try to come together as an industry and find out where we were vulnerable and heighten awareness immediately. That ad hoc navigation forum had a telephone tree associated with it that we've been using for months, getting ready for the low water situation in September and August. We activated that tree. Within about 3 hours, we were successful in sucking in a vast amount of information and taking it down by noon our time to the local U.S. Coast Guard base. They were pretty impressed with that. And of course, this shows our region with respect to the outreach that we took, but what it doesn't show is we had permission from headquarters of companies from Oslo, Norway, to Hong Kong, saying whatever you have in your database as an agent, make it available to the federal agencies in the United States. So we had clearance from people all around the world to go ahead and put together this profile. Coast Guard liked it. They asked us to come back 2 days later and sit down with Customs, INS, FBI, several intelligence agencies locally, and show them how we were able to bring this information in. We did that. People flipped open their laptops. They were able to show just-in-time inventories. They were able to show crew lists. They were able to show what kind of cargoes were being handled, were going to be handled, what was coming to this country in the next 5 days, the next 2 weeks, what had been here last year, the year before. We were able to put together a tremendous amount of information. Based on that, they asked us if we would be kind enough to give a similar presentation by video teleconference with Washington, D.C. And we were ready to go. It took them a couple weeks to get this set up. On the 26th, we brought in a handful of cross-section representation of the industry. At the other end, there were about 24 people in their room, so I don't know who all they were. I know it was the Naval Intelligence, CIA, FBI, Coast Guard, BTS people. The list goes on. It was mostly law enforcement and intelligence. They asked some very good questions, and in the course of about a 45-minute discussion, we crafted interim emergency rules for all ships calling in the United States. Okay, those were done here in Oregon, and 2 days later, they came out as interim emergency. They're now the standard that the United States is still using, invented right here in Oregon. What we recognized on the private sector side was if you take the ship information, which is shown in the gray box there that's just been covered up, that tells you where the ship is and where it's going and when it's going to get there. A lot of good stuff. But if you have the agent information about the crews and the cargoes and where it's been, you have a very powerful tool. Now, a definition of luck that I've heard often is when preparation meets opportunity. We saw both for us. We wanted to do these things. We wanted to find out if, in fact, we could capitalize on what the attention we were getting and the lessons we had learned. The problem we had is the first port security grants came out, and not a single port in anywhere on our river system was eligible. We weren't even eligible to compete. In my former life, I was a Coast Guard captain. I came here, I was your sector commander for a couple of years. Prior to that, I was the head of planning for the U.S. Coast Guard back in Washington, D.C. During that time, I had a few interesting things to deal with. Desert Storm, Desert Shield, Loma Prieta, and Exxon Valdez come to mind. So I had a few friends back in Washington, so I got on the phone, and I said, you know, it doesn't seem right that number one wheat, number two grain, number four ag, and a whole bunch of other things isn't eligible to compete. And they said, well, as a system, you certainly are. Nobody else is doing it as a system, though, but if you guys can, we'll consider your request. So we created this Regional Maritime Security Coalition to coordinate port security grants so we'd be eligible to get some money. We got 100% of what we asked for. We're the only entity in the United States that got 100%. And what that tells you as legislators is we didn't ask for enough. So at any rate, we were able to take that money and do a demonstration project.
And how much money was that?
$623,000, and we matched it with $250,000 of private sector money. That grew over the years, Senator Johnson, to approximately $5 million, which was matched about $1.75 private sector money. These are off the top of my head.
Where did the five come from?
The five came from the Transportation Security Administration, Department of Homeland Security, as a research and development cooperative agreement, which you're going to see shortly. It sort of took us out of the port security business. We let the ports go. There have been seven rounds of port security grants at this point. The first three, the RMSC coordinated. By the time we got to, I want to tell this one story if I can, and then get back to that point with your permission. Okay. We gave a proof of concept in what was then the governor's new operations center out there near I-5. And what we were able to do is take a real farmer's shipment of grain from Nebraska. His name was Dirk. And we were able to track it through the supply chain to a co-op in Colorado, to an elevator in Lewiston, Idaho, to barges. We were able to identify every truck, train, person, and barge that had been affected by this simulated contaminated cargo. Our objective was to show that we could track and surgically address the issue without doing what the FAA had to do to all the nation airlines on 9/11. We could do it surgically. We don't have to shut down all commerce. We can keep it moving. So they were so impressed with that they said, we'd like to use your region as a beta test site. And we would like to build on the lessons learned that you have. So we went into this partnership, and that answers the question, Senator. That's where the money came from over the period of years they continued to work with us.
And what's the status of RMSC now?
The RMSC is funded exclusively by private sector. It's kind of limping along, quite honestly. We've got lots of potential. I'm on the board of the RMSC, but I'm just one of many, many people on the board. So,
So what did $5 million buy?
Oh, you're going to see. And I am really anxious to show you.
Okay. Madam Chair, could we have a copy of the board and a copy of the organizational structure of RMSC, please?
Yes, ma'am. Not a problem. One of the things that we've used recently with good effect is this alert capability. It's more common today than it was back in 2004 and 5 when we started it, but it basically means that if you want to be notified at home on your pager, on your laptop, via email of an incident affecting transportation anywhere in the state or only in selected areas of the state, you pick the way you want to be notified, you will be. Right now, that's where my phone number comes in the most handy.
So could you explain that? You are just a recipient on your phone, or are you the initiating person of this phone tree, or how does that work exactly?
Well, if you don't get me, you'll get someone else who knows to go to the CRSOA, and our administrator now, as gift in kind of the RMSC, provides...
I'm lost in acronym.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Hell.
I promise not to do that. Okay, let's get back here. We have an we under contract have administrative services provided to our association.
Which association?
The Columbia River Steamship Operators Association.
Okay, I'm lost in the associations. We've got all these different organizations that are all interlocking, and I am completely baffled by how they all work.
All right. I think the simplest thing to think of, Senator, would be as the River Pilots and the Ship Operators Association, one's giving the brief today, working as a team and using the partnership we have with Customs, Coast Guard, and other federal and state agencies for the betterment of the region. And when a phone, if you get in touch with any of us through our administrator, and we have backup if the administration, administrative services of CRISO aren't available, we have other ways. There's a vetting process that has to be followed so that if the Coast Guard, for example, puts out a notice to mariners, we want to make sure that's accurate, but we can put that out. If the bar pilots close the bar because weather is adverse, we try to get it exactly in concurrence with them that we've got the message right, we'll put the message out.
So the bar pilots are calling your cell phone and then you're putting it out?
That's one example, yes, ma'am. And we did it to very good effect. I think it was an outstanding effort.
One more follow-up. I guess I'm just trying to understand how for $5 million we've got your cell phone, if the bar pilots close the bar, passing a message that seems to me to be a fundamental message. I mean, if the bar is closed forever and ever prior to all of this stuff and spending $5 million, somehow the word got out the bar was closed.
Yes. I guess I don't understand.
So now we've spent $5 million to use your cell phone to let people know the bar's closed.
Oh no, ma'am. That's just a minor example. It's just one that we find great value in. The $5 million didn't go for me for the folks to use my cell phone. The fact that we have this system in place that you can communicate securely with people that have a need to know, that's where the value is. I'm just giving one example of a piece of information that can be pushed over that system. And in a few minutes, I will show other pieces that I think you'll find interesting.
Maybe you'll get to this. Of the people that need to know, who's in the club? Who in your world constitutes need to know?
Customs brokers, freight forwarders, shippers, owners, operators, agents, tugboat companies, their dispatchers in particular, the river pilots, the bar pilots, in certain cases, definite law enforcement people, Oregon Emergency Management and Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, the U.S. Coast Guard, Customs. These are just off the top of my head. We've got quite a list of people that are on the network. And each one has to be vetted. And in a few minutes, I think you'll see some more of the vetting process as I get into this.
Okay.
I do appreciate the questions. Thank you. Commercial value is important. That was one of the things that we decided at the very beginning. The supply chain was important, but the idea of getting the private sector to see the commercial value means a couple of things. Not only will they pay for a lot of it, but they'll also make sure that the information that carried on the system is up to date, it's vetted, and if you have new technologies coming along to remain competitive using these tools, we have an incentive to continuously upgrade the systems that we have. We want to talk about VTIS now because that was the cornerstone that we built this on. And Paul, if you will again.
Sure. Paul Amos, Columbia River Pilots again. We'll talk to you a little bit about the two acronyms here. The VTIS is Vessel Traffic Information System. And VTS is a vessel traffic service. The big differences are the vessel traffic services are things like they have in Puget Sound or San Francisco. They're manned by a staff. They require a lot of radar equipment, office space, number of personnel to man it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is an example of one of the service centers, one of the largest areas, larger areas. These are examples of some of the areas that do use vessel traffic service, and typically they're areas that are open bays and or sounds that have wide bodies of water associated with traffic separation schemes. On the river, our channel is 600 feet wide for the 100 miles or so that we do, and there are no traffic separation zones. We meet head-to-head, and with 600 feet of channel, we have to share that with other vessels who are in it. So sometimes you don't have 300 feet available to you. So due to the terrain I mentioned before, a radar tracking system really isn't practical because if you get a scale that you can really tell what's going on, it's only a mile and a half or 3 miles long. You can't monitor much of the length of the river. So that's one of the reasons that contributed to those cost factor that really didn't make it very feasible to put something in the Columbia River, and we knew the traffic was going to increase over time, and so we wanted to find a way to manage traffic as best we could. So the AIS technology made that possible. As we mentioned before, all the ships in the world now have to have this AIS transponder. Our laptops are such that we can board a ship. We plug into the ships. There's a pilot plug mandated for all ships. We plug directly into the ship with our laptops. We get the ship's information, position information relayed to our laptops. Shows us our position and channel. We use the tower we mentioned before. I've got a graphic coming up. I'll talk more about the tower later. We use the information provided from the ship on our laptops to show us where we are in the channel and where other ships are in the channel, and allows us to predict accurately our meeting capabilities. It also has the channel depth surveys in there I mentioned before. So it provides a wealth of information to the pilot on hand. And the best thing about a vessel traffic information service, the VTIS, is that it puts the information in the hands of the decision makers on the bridge of the ships. It doesn't go through a third party somewhere in a windowless room downtown that has to interpret what they're seeing or maybe misinterpret what they're seeing. Things happen quickly enough in a 600-foot wide channel. You really need the information as much as possible in your hands as quickly as possible. So I've already described the AIS a little bit. Using a radar-based system, radar does have its limitations. These are examples of radars. The picture on the left is an example of about a mile and a half or so range on a radar. You really can't tell much about a channel. That's why a radar-based system won't really work on the river. And not all radars on this is radar on a ship, of course, and they're not all equally good. We have challenges looking out the window sometimes, construction of a ship. It's hard to see where you're going. So we use AIS technology. As we mentioned here, the signal will go from a ship to a tower that's located in Kalama, Washington right now. And it relays that over the mountains to ships in Astoria. We can cover the whole river with one tower in Kalama. We do have some blind spots down in the Astoria area, and we're expecting to put another tower up down there within the next few months to help eliminate those blind spots. But it's good enough we can manage traffic with it as it is.
Okay. I think that we're going to show some of the capabilities that the system allows, but I do want to mention that Coos Bay is also in the discussion on this. We think that the tower putting in Astoria is going to possibly be helpful with Coos Bay, but even if it isn't, it's not that expensive for us to do something in Coos Bay. With the things that that port's doing to try and grow business, we're paying attention to that region. We want to show that this is a standard NOAA chart, but you see it's overlaid with the GPS information, both the channel, the red lines that show with the channel, which is part of the VTIS, and pilots don't, they have to memorize all this stuff, so they really don't like that clutter on their screen. What they prefer is a simpler scene like this. Well, we picked this particular one because it shows the anchorage area. These are ships at anchor, swinging at anchor. You can see where they're swinging, where they're tending. It means a pilot that's coming downriver and wants to anchor, let's say in Astoria, can take a look down the river. The back and forth things that you see, that's where the Corps of Engineers survey boat tracked. So if we zoom in closer, you're going to be able to actually see what the depth soundings are. And I'll get to that in a few moments. We have a sample to show. Another beautiful advantage is if you happen to be an incoming ship, let's say this one right here, as a pilot, you can say, okay, I want to know what ships on the river I'm going to meet, when I'm going to meet them, and where I'm going to meet them. And these translucent blue bubbles automatically come on and say that the people moving out of the river and people and you moving in stay at the same course and speed, here's where you're going to meet. Well, what if it's a place with a lot of red, let's say? Well, you can say undesirable by the pilot. Okay, that's what we're showing you. You can zoom in closer, and you can see you can move the vessel to a place where it's safe to meet. I offered this for a couple of reasons. One is it does show you the actual depth soundings from the survey. We can also put, from any pilot's laptop, a security zone around a vessel or around a facility. That security zone, if it's penetrated by any unauthorized vessels, will set an alarm that notifies everybody that has to be notified. So it's a system-wide capability. It can be sliced and diced, tailored to specific needs, and as I say, automatically triggered. Google Earth is something I think we're all familiar with. We were really intrigued with this earlier on, but we've used it so much now that we seldom put Google Earth on, but we want to show you the capabilities. Situational awareness, best example I can give you, it's black as night, it's raining cats and dogs, and you're on a ship somewhere, and you'd kind of like to see how your ship might be in its aspect to other vessels. And we could zoom in a whole lot closer. I didn't have one of those to make available for this transparency. But as you're seeing, as you zoom in, you can actually see how things are laying in the river, even when visibility is just non-existent. So it helps you see where your ship is relative to the other barriers and the bridges and the other vessels in the area, as if it was a bright noonday sun.
Madam Chair, could we go back to the security slide for just a second?
If I can handle the technology, yes, ma'am.
Well, we all remember what it looks like. Just for the sake of the conversation, would that include, say, a LNG tanker?
Yes, ma'am, it would. If we wish to pursue that, you bet.
If I may, Paul Amos with River Pilots again. This technology is used by the Boston pilots on LNG ships they bring in there. So it's the same software. Volpe's in Boston, and they use Boston pilots as testing grounds for some of what we do here. So this is what they use in Boston.
And it does have encryption capability so that the law enforcement vessels that want to be invisible to everybody else can. So our system has that just like the Boston system. We actually went to Boston and visited with them back in 2005 to see what ideas we could steal. Now, we didn't know LNG might be a possibility, but we wanted to see what they were doing with respect to hazardous materials in a crowded metropolitan area just so we'd have safety. Possibilities. Now, this is showing zooming into logging trails. And the reason this is valuable with Google Earth is you can find logging trails like this. If you had an incident, let's say it was a maritime spill, and you wanted to stage cleanup here and you wanted to find the best way to get it there by land and or water, having this Google Earth capability really helps first responders. Now we're going to show a bunch of cameras. I'm going to go through these really quick because I want to show you. Everybody's got their own camera system, and I'm sure you can appreciate there's interface difficulties. Part of that $5 million was spent on building the integration between existing camera systems and installing new camera systems. So again, just the camera piece is what we're about to go through. We work with Oregon Department of Transportation in getting MOU in place to get proprietary access to their cameras. Of course, the quid pro quo is they get access to everything that you're seeing here, too, when they need it. Wireless video. Now, this was taken from a tugboat bridge as it was going, approaching a lock and going into the lock. Again, all wirelessly, and it was using the Morrow County wireless net. That's part of the chemical stockpile emergency preparedness program there. That's part of the county had to put together a special way of notifying its citizens and of communicating if the Umatilla missiles that are being incinerated were to have an accident. That was the system we decided to build on. They'd already worked out a lot of the bugs, and they had a wealth of experience in work using wireless. So this particular tug was going through that area, and we were able to beam this. And this particular picture you're seeing was taken from a computer in Portland. So it was downloaded from that. Public sector facilities, Corps of Engineers has cameras. They want access to ours. We'd like access to theirs. Okay. Again, Foster tug going through McNary Lock. Okay. Part of the port security program in round three, we got with Lewis and Clark coming up in 2005, we were able to get cameras at ports that handle lots of passengers. Cascade Locks is one of them. So there's a view from their camera. And the thing is, if you had the password, you could go to your laptop right now or your home and log onto your computer and have access to this. And with the right password, you could actually pan tilt zoom the cameras yourself. Obviously, those capabilities are given to very, very few people. But point is, it's a browser-based system. Okay, Port of Umatilla and Clarkston. Again, all of these are pictures that were taken directly, downloaded from their cameras as they fed into offices in Portland. Law enforcement cameras in Hermiston, the Bourbon Rest area. Again, just want to show the reach. And Hinkle Rail Yard is a real coup on our part because the Department of Homeland Security was blown away when they saw this. They were saying, you know, we've been working for 18 months, 2 years, trying to get Union Pacific or Burlington Northern to let us have access to their information. And they let you put a camera in Hinkle Rail Yard. Now, Hinkle Rail Yard, for Union Pacific, that's the largest engine repair yard west of Chicago. They have security concerns there. We did it by using supply chain relationships. People that do business with wheat, that do business with the railroad, they explained why this was important. They said, sure. So we put the camera in and got to use it. Now, those are plume models. They're real-time from Morrill County, right next to Umatilla. And what that shows is if you had a spill at the depot, based on current wind conditions, and each ring shows a different type of chemical product, that's the most likely way it would be impinged. Now, our tug operators found this useful because they go by there all the time. If they had laptops and had a spill, they'd be able to look, wouldn't have to make calls, radio calls, they'd be able to see exactly whether it was a place they wanted to stay away from or not. This was a beta test that we did with the Coast Guard, and we did it directly with headquarters, U.S. Coast Guard headquarters. It was with an admiral named Allen, who I think you all heard about after Katrina and Rita. And Admiral Allen personally cleared the way so we could do this. What we wanted to do was to use fixed facilities that the Coast Guard already has for ACE navigation. They have battery-powered solar arrays that light their lights. And we said if we could put Wi-Fi transmitters and link them together so you could daisy-chain information up and down, here's one of the things you'd be able to do. And, oh, by the way, if you're a passenger in the car doing 70 miles an hour on Interstate 84, you can also check your email, check the sports scores, send email. It's just as if you were in your home office. And this is good for, because rivers usually also are the sites of rail and major highways, you're helping the other modes as well. Okay. Now, we information sharing, I've mentioned, I'm going to blast through these pretty quick. And it's bills of lading. The reason it's important you're able to get those into your system is marginal notes that truckers or barge operators make on a bill of lading changes the status of the cargo. You may have an electronic shipment and not know that some of it has been diverted because it was marginally written on a bill of lading. But if we can gather this information and put it into the central location of the secure network, you can know much more accurately what the true status of cargo is. Now, how do we get the private sector information vetted and keep the private sector involved in this thing? We populate it with real-world information. We're getting close to the end now. And we also try to increase the number of folks that are involved. When you see the last line on here, you might be a bit surprised. We had that top officials exercise here in October of 2007. They saw what we were doing. The Walmart Pacific Corps Northwest Natural have recently joined the Board of Directors of the Regional Maritime Security Coalition. They want to either see if, by learning from our experience, we can build something else in Oregon, or we might change the Regional Maritime Security Coalition to be something that's broader than it currently is. But that's the thinking. And so all of these folks see real potential in the systems that we put together. We created something called the grain line. Very important because it enables grain ships that are moved on and off dock to get various types of... They have multiple holds, and the grain isn't always available for them. So they have to move on and off dock, and that there's labor, tugs, pilots. There's big expenses involved with that. So if you can get an idea when your ship's going to move and where it is in the line, you can save money. Okay, VTIS analysis tools, Paul's talked about that a little bit. Audit trails, I might mention that all the cameras we use have about 2 weeks archived video footage for the servers that were put in place. Okay. Vehicle decal program is important. This, just to show how you can make a couple of things, there's a requirement over here that all people that work on the waterfront view a awareness training video the Coast Guard makes available. The decal was something we invented because every port had its own requirements, and to get on a port, everybody's going to have a different decal. Your windshield will be covered with these things. So we went to the ports of Vancouver, Portland, and Longview and got their buy-in first. If we could all agree that we use the same decal, then agents, pilots, ship chandlers and vendors and surveyors and all could get on your facility so they didn't have to wait, park their car, wait for a jitney bus in the rain at 2 o'clock in the morning to go down and service a ship. All of you can appreciate you wouldn't want to do that. You'd like to be able to drive your car on. Well, by vetting the insurance requirements, vetting the fact that you had to view and did view these required training, as you see, we can marry a lot of different things. The beauty of the security network is that every guard shack and every terminal that has access to the web can access this system, pull it up, and see if that number matches the credentials that the individual driving the car is presenting, has the insurance, has the training. It's a beautiful system that the ports have asked us to continue. Now, these are various databases that Oregon has that we've used in exercises, critical highway. And this is a really neat one right here. Turns out, this is something we invented, again, part of the R&D effort. Burlington Northern numbers its tracks from east to west, and Union Pacific from west to east. And if you have an incident, you can be on Union Pacific and say, I just had a chlorine track, a car derail, and it's leaking at mile 82. Well, the state highway patrol doesn't know that. Our barge industry doesn't know where Union Pacific mile 82 is. So by putting this on the system, you can enter basically what you do know from your language, and it translates it automatically for everybody else. This does not exist system-wide. We did it in a few places to demonstrate the capability. We're looking for people that might be interested in expanding it further. We just offered as another example of some of the things that are possible because of this information sharing. We showed you this before. Because it's based on supply chain information, it's real-time, vetted, right up to date by the people that are moving the stuff. We're able to assess it in terms of what that's saying is that the green, basically, it's been vetted. You know, the cargo, whether it's rail cargo, truck cargo, barge cargo, we can verify that it's been securely handled. Red is questionable. Red can also mean somebody in the supply chain is providing financing for this, and we don't recognize who they are, somebody from Dubai or somebody from... anything that looks suspicious, we can highlight as red, post it to the net, and federal agencies and state agencies that are interested in security can watch this.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I want to ask a question here about... your presentation is impressive, but why do we hear so much about drugs coming into our country if indeed you're vetting this cargo and you've got this system of being able to alert people to this? What part have you played in the drug trafficking?
None at all to this point, with the only exception being the InfraGuard link with the FBI. The FBI is interested in the InfraGuard's more for security than for drugs. I have to say that right up front. What we're vetting is the cargoes that we know are in the system. Drugs we don't know about. We haven't investigated that. If you had some proposals for that, we'd be happy to discuss with you what the possibilities might be. But honestly, what we're trying to do is just assure the security of the cargoes that we're moving through the system now, which wouldn't include drugs.
You've been talking a lot about partnerships, and given all the public money involved in this exercise up to this point, do you have any existing relationship or do you contemplate any relationship with the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network?
We have been given their names. Now, the folks that have been instrumental in that is honestly the Easy Wireless people that did a lot of the wireless connect up here.
A vendor.
Yes, they're a consultant and a vendor. They provided the Morrow County system, and they're linking us up to other possible vendors, and I've heard that name mentioned, Madam Senator. I have not talked with anybody.
Well, Madam Chair, when you started this presentation, it was, part of your value in being here is if we hear anything that we want to let you know. Well, the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network is a $400-plus million undertaking by the state to share information. Might be useful for you to check in with them.
Thank you very much. I want to point out that even though we use terrorism as the background, if you think in terms of mad cow disease, genetically engineered products and the concerns associated with that, one of the possibilities that the system we are building offers is the opportunity to track surgically cargoes of interest and get them back to the source through the supply chains that are actually moving.
Madam Chair, yes.
You're going to help me with that one. You've got a load of cows someplace, and you've got a sick cow. And you guys can track a sick cow.
Not us. But we know the folks in the supply chain that move the meat that will be able to talk to the people in the agricultural business that actually did the slaughtering and, on their records, track it back to the farmer from which it came.
Why wouldn't they go directly to the Department of Ag with that?
In that particular case, they might.
Okay.
Rob, if you would, please.
Madam Chair of the Committee.
And you are.
I am. I've been pretty quiet here for a while. I'm Rob Rich from Shaver Transportation Company in Portland. We're a tug and barge company, a fifth-generation Oregon family-owned company. We have about 100 high-paying union jobs that our company represents. The slide we have up here is one of our barge tows. Each of those barges is capable of holding about 3,600 tons of wheat. That's actually a light tow. The normal Columbia River tow is four barges, which carry about 14 to 15,000 tons of wheat in each movement. The communication system that has been set up down the river here in the last few years has allowed us to coordinate our lockages. And what does all of that mean? You look out at the river, you don't see all that much activity on the river. There are over 500 barge tows a year that transit down the Columbia River here to the port of Portland and Vancouver and Klamath and Longview. With all of those lockages, you have an enormous amount of water spilled out of each lock. If the lockages are coordinated, meaning that an upstream tow is arriving at the lock before a downstream tow does, if the water is in position in the lock so that they don't have to dump it for the tow to go in, the first tow there takes advantage of that, up it goes. To get less technical, the long and the short of it is, with communication, we have less wastage of water. And we all know what the water situation on our Columbia River system is as far as cool for the fish, irrigation water for farmers. The recreational use is probably a pretty minor effect there, but specifically because of hydropower production and trying to maintain the Corps of Engineers water control, the less wastage that our industry can have, the better. Just a quick note about the towboat industry, which assists every one of the 1,800 or more ships that call in our river system each year, which account for, I believe, close to 4,500 ship movements in the Columbia Snake River system. Those are numbers that most people don't get to hear. It's an amazing amount of shipping that's moving in and out of our ports. Our company, for one, and the other companies that are on the river are changing out our 1970s vintage locomotive engines out of our tugs to Tier 2 compatible engines that have very low carbon footprints, use approximately 33% less fuel than the engines they replace, and makes for a much cleaner airshed going up and down the Columbia Gorge, which is a concern for everybody. The last piece that I would like to throw out here is, Jim has mentioned several times, and you may be picking up from Paul here as well, the competitiveness of our river system here. This is a very large system, and I've thrown out some pretty big numbers, the tonnages, the number of barge tows and ship calls. But if this river system isn't competitive against the Port of Seattle, against the San Francisco Bay ports, against L.A. Long Beach, and yes, admittedly, they move different cargoes than we do, but we still have to be competitive. Every piece of this market has to be competitive. The ability of ships to get in and out of berth, the ability for ships to be loaded to their maximum drafts that the river will accept, the ability for the cargoes to move by rail, truck, and by barge, to be here on time, in time, for those shipments. It's all one big piece that works together, and I, for one, am certainly thankful to have this opportunity for us to get to share today. Appreciate the pointed questions that we've had, and we'll appreciate any other questions as we finish here. Thank you.
And this is the last slide, so we wanted to leave it something you don't often get to see in Oregon. Not too many people actually witness the loading of a grain vessel, but that's what's going on here. But we want to make the point that with better information sharing and the VTIS technology, we're getting better and better all the time at using the water that's available to us, at scheduling crews and pilots, at scheduling line handlers, the tugs, all the service providers, and in marketing this as if you come here as a ship owner operator, your ship's going to be have a lot of uncertainty removed. You're going to be able to be assured that you'll be navigated, you know, navigation would provide it safely and securely, and that you're going to get a pretty good value for the cost that you pay. We're hoping this is going to attract more customers, and in particular, we're hoping it's going to preserve the jobs and possibly grow the jobs that we have in our industry. Now, we've had some really good questions, but I'm very happy to entertain others if anyone would like to ask.
Senator Monroe.
Thank you. I've worked for more than a decade on the Columbia River Crossing Project. I was, prior to returning to the Senate, I was a Metro Councilor.
Mm-hmm.
Wondered if you were involved in planning for that project. I know that the current highway bridge and the rail bridge half mile downstream require an S movement for your barge to get through, which is very dangerous. Your pilots must be outstanding because so far they haven't hit the bridge. If they had, maybe we would be able to get some federal money to fix it. The federal government's kind of funny about that. They, before they'll decide something is an emergency situation and needs to be repaired, you have to actually have an accident. Just wondered what your involvement was in the planning for the Columbia River crossing, because while we're fixing highway and transit across that river, we also ought to be improving maritime travel up and down the river as well.
Mm-hmm. I'll take the first cut on that. Rob Rich, Shaver Transportation Company. The towboat lines on the river were brought together by the Coast Guard and had the opportunity to give testimony. The Columbia River Steamship Operator Association, of course, has had that opportunity. Jim will talk a little more about that. But Columbia River Towboat Operators Association, as a group, and towboat companies individually, including some of our boat crews, were able to give written testimony as well as in front of the mic testimony for the Coast Guard, bridge planners. Austin Pratt out of Seattle District Coast Guard held a series of meetings down here, so the towboat lines were given great opportunity to share in that.
Paul? Well, I don't have much to add to that. Paul Amos of the Columbia River Pilots. As a former towboat captain, I had to make that S turn many times, and it was pretty frightening, and we came close. But we didn't, you know, I was at the hearing I think you referred to some years ago where they flat told us if they can't fix it, we haven't hit it enough times. We don't have enough accidents to warrant spending that kind of money. So we do our best not to hit things. But actually, our efforts haven't been too much involved in the Columbia Crossing project at all, I think was the original question. We're more involved with the movement of cargo on the river itself as opposed to things like that.
And the strategy, Jim Towne, Executive Director of Columbia River Steamship Operators, on this particular issue, the strategy we've adopted is individual members give the testimony. As an association, we haven't really engaged on the crossing issue. We were actively involved with an attempt to get some federal money to reconfigure the railroad bridges here, and I think you and I may have met in a public session back then where we gave testimony, and that was the very issue. The fact that we have an excellent safety record was playing against us in trying to get federal money to rebuild the bridges for the railroad.
If I may add something here, maybe help clarify some of what you've seen here. You've seen a lot of information here today. Paul Amos of the River Pilots again, I'm sorry. A lot of what you've seen here we use day-to-day in the marine industry and as we navigate the river. A lot of what you've seen here, the information sharing part, really comes into play in a catastrophic emergency, such as an earthquake that we're predicted to have, or Mount St. Helens in the past, floods, the top off four exercise where there was a dirty bomb going off in downtown Portland. So a lot of this, the purpose of this and the SEAC, the Cargo Information Action Center, that comes together in response to an emergency or catastrophic situation. That way you have all the information related to the marine industry. It's not a broad encompass everything, but it's all we know about the marine industry, the cargo placement, the location of vessels. We know where that is. We come together in a single unit somewhere and make that information available to the state on-scene coordinators, federal on-scene coordinators. So if they have a question in regard to marine transportation or cargo whereabouts, we can answer those questions for them. And it's available to anyone who needs that service. So it provides things in top off four. I believe we showed a point where the river traffic was stopped. There may have been a long-term need for fuel. We found a fuel barge cargo that was trapped, couldn't move, and it could be made available to emergency responders for their fuel supplies had it come to a position where they couldn't get fuel otherwise. So it locates cargo that can be used in an emergency. And the better part of it is, as well, the fire department, police, sheriff, whatever, responding to the emergency, we can start focusing on the recovery, which needs to start happening almost simultaneously as you're responding to the emergencies itself. You have to start building for the recovery effort and get this thing moving back to normal. So that's a lot of what you saw here, is get that information together in one spot and get the recovery started.
I have Senator Metzger and Senator Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was curious. I see Captain Lewin, who's a Columbia River Bar Pilots Manager of the Bar Pilots, is here in the room. So I was curious about, with your information systems, since they bring the ships in, take them back out when you bring them to Astoria, and a bottleneck, especially if the bar is going to be closed or whatever, or some identification. You mentioned just a little bit, but not much in the presentation. Could you describe what partnership that you then with the system have with them and what that role would be with the ships that are moving in and out of the bar itself?
Yes, we're Paul Amos and Clem River Pilots. We're in close communication with the bar. Our dispatchers are on the phone with each other throughout the day, so we stay closely coordinated. We try to get our ships, deep ships to Astoria at an appropriate tide for them. They try to bring them in at an appropriate tide for us. So we work closely with them on a daily basis. And the system you saw here really hasn't been extremely useful for them because we just had the one tower in Kalama set up as a test site to see if it worked. It hasn't worked well. And that's why we're going to put the tower in the Astoria area. That would, we had blind spots and gaps in coverage, so it hasn't been real beneficial to them. We have given them a copy of this TV32 software. They have it in their office down there, so they can use it to the extent that the signals they do receive. But hopefully, getting that second tower downriver will eliminate those gaps, and it'll be a more a usable system for them. But they do have a copy in their office.
I want to make several points to you. One is that as former mayor of Coos Bay, how much I have appreciated over the years the cooperation of the pilots and the struggles that we've had in Coos Bay and the sympathetic response that we've had. In an emergency situation such as the Carissa, we had 300 people that were there from all kinds of offices in the federal government, and you were the people that knew most about what was supposed to be done. And so for that, I really thank you. I do want to say, though, that part of the problem with the development of the ports or with your port as it is today with the traffic coming in on rail that is not being maintained. And I hear that from the Eastern Oregon people that, you know, if we aren't going to be able to do something with these rail companies, that they will go in and repair and keep those rails in some kind of condition. The ports and your jobs are really hard because it makes a tremendous difference in the wheat farmer who has the wheat falling out of the cars as it takes off to get down to the Port of Portland. So, but in clarification, you said RMSC. I'm just not familiar. You need to tell me who that is and what they do.
Yes, ma'am. The name was Regional Maritime Security Coalition, and that was a group of ports, shippers, pilots, terminals. We've got Brad Witt, for example, from the House, is one of the chair. He'd be representing union interests on this particular entity. And it was put together so that we as a system, which included Coos Bay and several other ports along the coast, could go forward initially and get port security grant money. And we were successful in that endeavor for the first three rounds. When round four came, that's when the Transportation Security Administration suggested, we'd really rather give you guys money, you match 25% or 20%, and we'd like to use you as a beta test. So we went down that road. And now we're at a point where we have to make a decision whether we get back in the port security business or not. If we do, then the issues that you're raising with respect to rails is something that the RMSC might be involved with. Right now, they are not.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Kuchin.
Thank you. As long as we're on RMSC, how are they funded now?
They're funded primarily by our organization, the components that we found valuable. What we found valuable was the alerting piece and the information sharing pieces on grain lineups and things of that nature. So we're still funding that. Yes, ma'am.
What role do you play in both of those organizations? I mean, obviously, you're the executive director of the steamship. What's
yes,
your
ma'am.
Role with RMSC?
I'm on the board with 15 other people.
And that's the list you're going to give us?
Yes, ma'am.
And the org structure?
Yes.
What's RMSC's total budget right now?
Oh, at the moment, it's not much. We're talking in the tens of thousands. So it's not much.
Tens of thousands.
Yes, ma'am. Not hundreds or millions at this point. With respect to what they do.
I don't understand that answer.
Okay. They are an educational and coordination entity. That's why they were put up to do two things. They were to try to educate and they were to try to relieve the burden of government. The money that was provided by the government enabled us to use the relationships we have to beta test some really neat things and to build value. TSA reorganized in 2007, took all of the R&D money that they had been using on service transportation, put it into aviation. All the people in TSA that had been working on our project either left the organization or wound up being reorganized in other places. So the money that they had promised us in 2008 never came. It put us in a bad position because they had asked us in 2006 to try and become 100% self-sufficient by 2009, and we were on that track. Now we're still moving down that track, but very slowly. All the capabilities that we're demonstrating, we're showing you, are either in place, like the alerting piece, the access to camera piece, the VTIS piece for sure. That's something we're funding in the hundreds of thousand dollars level, but we're not putting it through MRC. We're doing it directly with the pilots.
Just as a curiosity, are MRC meetings open?
No, they are not.
You're funneling a lot of federal money through. Why would they not be open?
Well, it's the issues are a matter of security at times. So it's never come up as an issue. You just never even asked the question. There have been times when people have asked if they could come to the meetings, and because of the issues on the docket, many of which had to do with security discussions, we couldn't allow it. But that doesn't mean we couldn't invite the public to certain meetings. It just hasn't ever been proposed.
Thank you, gentlemen. I must say I'm a little puzzled, but maybe because I don't have a port anywhere, you know, in the vicinity of my district, and I probably have a number of questions have been raised in my mind, but I'm gonna probably maybe talk offline and not take any more time here. But I appreciate your coming and providing the information, and it seems like there's a lot of good information there. Just have to work it through my brain a little bit.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair,
again
for the opportunity.
And I'll go ahead and close the informational hearing. And with that, I think we have Hans Bernard from the Governor's Office who's here and just give us a brief update on Governor's Interim Committee.
Good afternoon, Representative Beyer, Senator Metzger. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. For the record, my name is Hans Bernard, representing the Governor's Office, one of his transportation policy staff people. I wanted to provide you an update on the process that the Governor has been engaging in to develop a legislative proposal that he will bring to you, hopefully in the mid-November time frame. As you may recall, in January, the Governor formed three committees to deal with the issue of transportation and assist him in preparing a package to bring to you in the 2009 legislative session. The first, I'll give you an update on all three of those. The first is a public awareness effort that was chaired by the Governor's Chief of Staff, Chip Terhune, and is designed to develop and obtain information on public opinion as it relates to the issue. An update there, frankly, we have not been able to move as fast as we had liked. The group was able to engage in a first set of work and had a deliverable there. In the second phase, had selected Conkling, Fiscom, and McCormick and the firm of PacWest to partner in an effort to do some public opinion research. To my knowledge, it is disappointing to report to you today that a contract has not been signed with them. My understanding is that those two firms have done the work that they can do to the point of a contract, but we are working to encourage the folks who will be contracting with them to expedite that paperwork so we can get the information that we believe we need and you need as soon as possible. My understanding at this point is it is a 501c3 effort organized by several of the business organizations and primarily by the Associated General Contractors. The second committee that the governor had convened was a governance effort designed to develop a series of recommendations on how we could make sure that when the governor asked for additional resources for the transportation system, we did so in a way that was responsible with the public dollars and placed you folks in a position where you could feel confident in supporting additional revenue that was going to be spent well by the public's and earning the public's trust. That group has concluded its work and developed a list of recommendations ranging from specific policy proposals that would streamline the process by which folks could enter into intergovernmental agreements to speed expedite project delivery, to the simple solution of ensuring that there is a $1 placeholder in the e-board bill so that when ODOT is presented an opportunity to co-locate facilities with cities and counties around the state and save local and state government money, that they are not put in the position of saying having to say no because there is not that placeholder. So that list of recommendations has been forwarded on to the Transportation Vision Committee, which is the third group that many of you have participated in or tracked the conversations on. That group has spent a great deal of time preparing a long-term vision statement for where Oregon's transportation should be in the year 2030, a copy of which I have provided for you today. That document is meant to be the place where that group matches whatever investment proposal that they develop for the 2009 session with, to make sure that we are moving Oregon in the right direction in terms of developing a more sustainable, a more complete, and a more thoughtfully funded transportation system in the state. Over the course of the summer months, that group split into three work groups, an environmental work group that was tasked with developing specific sustainability proposals that could be included in a transportation package in 2009, a second group that was tasked with looking at multimodal investment and making sure that we continue the good work that you have done bypassing Connect Oregon 1 and 2 and sustaining the critical investments in Oregon's non-highway transportation system. And the third group was really asked to look at what are the concrete revenue options as it relates to a highway funding package proposal. Those groups have come up with draft recommendations, which we are currently in the process of reviewing at the full committee level and merging into a single report that we are hoping will be complete and able to be sent to the governor in the mid-October timeframe for him to spend some time thinking about and then deliver to you for your consideration in mid-November. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions that folks may have.
Senator Johnson, thank you. I know that you guys have put in an incredible amount of time in these committee meetings. I have seen the schedule of them, and you have more than anybody else I'm aware of. At what point will the report be out in the public domain? Will it go to the governor first and then be in public?
My assumption at this point is the committee will forward their work to the governor in mid-October, and then he will take it under consideration and make it public in the mid-November timeframe.
And follow-up manager, for those of us that haven't done the due diligence that you all that have been in the committee meetings have done, when you said multimodal, for those of us like Senator Berger and me who have short lines and are very, very interested in airports and aviation operations, can you give us any kind of a preview about the inclusion of in a big package of any rail or aviation?
Absolutely. The governor, when he spent some time touring the state after Connect Oregon 2 projects were selected, made it very clear in those visits that Representative Beyer and Senator Metzger attended with him that the low watermark in any project or package that he proposes to the legislature would be a Connect Oregon program, a Connect Oregon 3 program of at least $100 million in lottery-backed funding.
Any other questions? Okay. I guess you got off pretty easy. I know that we've had a few discussions in the past, and I just thought it would give us an opportunity to at least update you on progress and timelines with Senator Johnson again.
You do raise an interesting question, Madam Chair, and that is the role of the two committees in the House and the Senate in advancing a package. And at what point will the committees be made aware of what the proposals are or be able to craft or change any of the proposals? I know that Madam Chair has attended nearly all the meetings, maybe missed two or something, but I'm just wondering, will this be session work or will there be any pre-session disclosure to these two committees?
It is my hope at this point that in the October time frame, when we have a document that has been sent from the group to the governor, that we would have a chance to have conversations with each of you and get input as it relates to what you believe is a good way for the governor to proceed forward. It is also my hope that the governor would take the opportunity to present this package to these two committees before the 2009 legislative session.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess that what is really important for me, and that is to know where this funding is going to come from for this package. And I think that I am extremely concerned that we are going to continue to go back to the automobile industry for our funding. And with the economy as it is, with the change in the gas prices, and with the new manufacture of hybrids and the potential of electric cars, with every closure of an automobile dealership, you're looking at a minimum of 45 people out of work. And so I think that I'm very concerned about where that funding is going to come from, because we are $119 million down. And the budget is going to be a very tight budget.
Thank you. Senator Monroe,
thank you, Representative Byer. Madam Chair and I have participated in most of these meetings. I'd just like to say, I'd like to thank the governor and the governor's office, because the group that we put together really represents all of the interest groups that have an interest in transportation in this state. All of them have had total opportunity to have input all the way from, you know, the highway users folks, the truckers, to, you know, representatives of the environmental community and so on. Everybody has played a role, and things are coming together. It's not quite there yet, but things are coming together, and we think there'll be good recommendations. Also, we've been looking at basically short run and long run. So in the short run, basically the funding sources would tend to be similar to what we've seen in the past: auto registration fees and title fees, and possibly gas tax, although that's maybe off the table. But the usual kinds of things, weight mile and so on. In the long run, though, everybody understands that the current way that we fund our highway system in particular, primarily with a gas tax, will soon be obsolete. It's really outmoded. And so we've been talking a lot about, you know, what the next funding mechanism will be, possibly even repealing the gas tax in a few years and replacing it with something. So, you know, this is a very thoughtful group of people that have been meeting and working very hard, not only looking at what we can do in the next couple of years to try and take care of some of the very serious transportation problems in the state, but also a decade or two out, what's the system going to look like. And we've also been very aware of what's happening with gas prices and with the economy, and with the explosion of transit ridership and so on, and the need for a balanced package that recognizes that one person in an automobile is not the only way for people to get around, that there are other options, and those options ought to be encouraged, and there ought to be some dollars to help fund those other options. So in trying to make this a balanced package as well. We're not there yet. But I've appreciated the way the governor's staff have put this together, and the way they've invited such a wide variety of interest groups to the table So all have full participation.
Thank you. Senator Berger, may I comment?
Yes, I'd like to just respond because I also was on a committee. I've done most of my work by phone because of the location where I live. I've also been a member of the Road User Fee Task Force as I believe Senator Starr has been a member. We've been on that route for years, looking at ways that, because we could see that the gas tax was going, the revenue was going to fall, irregardless of the price of gasoline. What I think we are just faced with, and maybe we need to just address it at this time, even though we don't have an obsolete gas tax, we need to look at the long-term funding for this and stop going to the same industry over and over. We keep going back to the same trough. And I think that that particular industry is going through a lot of growing pains and changing. And I think that because of the economy, we need to realize that. And I am concerned. I think the package is good. I've certainly had my input into it, and I appreciate being allowed to have that input. But I do believe that we are going to have to look at the economy right now and what it is, unless it changes by 09, which it might.
We can only hope.
Well, I'm giving the gavel over, but thank you for coming, and keep up the good work.
And as always, both myself and my counterpart, Chris Warner, are available to any of you at any point if you have questions or concerns about the way we're moving forward. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we're going to have one more brief presentation. Before we do that, the rules for our interim committee, they've asked that we submit any committee requests for drafting now so that before we get into regular session, we would have that possible introduction of committee measures, that they would actually get working on them, and they want to know what they are. I only heard from Senator Monroe, from members on one that he would like to get drafted for us to consider, and then I have three, so I'll just tell you what they are. And I think Senator Monroe, I think everybody has a copy of this, kind of your idea. I'm requesting that a bill be drafted for possible introduction by the committee later this fall to require a permit for self-purchase of catalytic converters, and you can read Senator Monroe's idea there. We do have Heidi from Legislative Council. Not all these will probably go to her, but at least any ideas on this thought you might want to share with Senator Monroe as you talk about it. Also, requesting, we've had a lot of discussion about ethanol, and I'm sure there'll be a number of bills on that. I'm asking that a bill be drafted that would require that for the current ethanol fuel mandate to be in effect. It must be demonstrated that the ethanol required for blending requires less total energy to produce than it actually delivers. Now, so that's going to take a while to figure out how that's going to be analyzed and who's responsible, but I think that'll be the subject that that we can talk about that. The third one that I'm asking be drafted, and Senator Starr, I've heard this a few times, Multnomah County believes that it doesn't have authority to toll the Willamette River bridges, et cetera, et cetera. So, fine, I'm going to ask that a bill be drafted that will grant explicit authority of Multnomah County to toll the Willamette River bridges, and we can have that discussion at that time. And finally, this is germane to our just discussion about the gas tax. Joanne, and your comments were very, very true about long-term, and I know Senator Starr has been working on trying to get people to understand that long-term we're going to be changing, but currently, certainly fuel taxes are still, as a user fee, is our number one source of that. And it's interesting to know, and I have the Department of Transportation doing this, when you talk about fuel prices, portion of the gallon of gas attributed to the state gas tax is now the lowest in history. It used to be 17-22%. Now it's only 6.3%. It's the lowest it's ever been. I'm asking that a bill be drafted that will establish the state gas tax as a set percentage of the retail price of gasoline. It would never exceed that. And so you'll know how much of your cost of your gallon of gas goes to the state gas tax would stay the same. So that will be an interesting discussion. And it will still be the lowest it's been in a long time. Yes, Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chair, one other one, an issue that came to my attention yesterday, and I didn't, frankly, have the time to prepare it for the committee's review today, but I was contacted by a constituent who was aware of the decriminalization of some of the driving while suspended rules. And his concern, and I haven't researched this yet, but I'd like to at least bring it to the attention of the committee. At one time, DWS was a felony. In certain instances, it's now an infraction. And that we may have a situation with driving multiple driving while suspended where, in effect, there's no sanction, and they become scofflaws, driving while suspended. And I haven't done the requisite research to have a fully developed concept. I haven't visited with Ledge Council, but I'd at least like to raise the issue in this forum.
Well, that's great. One thing I would recommend, too, Senator Johnson, I know our policy committee heard an issue last year on that. Senator Winters has been real active in the driving while suspended issue in general. I know she has a plethora of information on that, so she might be a good one to start talking to, but she may be...
Vote to self. Call Senator
Winters. May be working on it. Okay. So that's now. So we have a brief presentation. Yes,
so, Mr. Chair, are we going to... basically approve this list now?
No, it's not required to approve the list. Just to notify you that I'm asking to be drafted. And then when they'll get them drafted, and then we'll bring those to committee and ask to be introduced as committee measures like we would normally do sometime later this fall. If you have, what I would ask, though, if you know any of these topics, these general topics, if you have some kind of thoughts about how you might want to draft those as initial concepts, really right now that they're just one sentence deal. So. I would imagine, for example, on the retail price of gas will probably just be a blank. You know, that's just going to be a subject matter for discussion in session. But it's a different way to look at it than just looking at it just in terms of real sense. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, not to pour any cold water on your idea, but more than 30 years ago, Representative Ed Lindquist suggested that we ought to make the gas tax a percentage or index it to inflation. And I supported him at that time, and if we'd have done it, we'd have more money than we need right now.
Yeah. Well, that's a different approach. This would not be an inflationary one. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. There's been another proposal, Representative Clemay.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's very talkative for the senators.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I've been approached by several constituents concerned about cell phone use and asking me to propose a bill that would require hands-free cell phones while driving. So I would like the committee to consider that.
Yeah, that'd be your case. So it's within a bar can get that.
Right. Great.
Okay. Okay, so who's doing our presentation? Travis? This is supposedly it's 15 minutes and we'll be done. Correct, Travis?
Less.
5 minutes.
Or less. Travis is going to kind of update us on the more bad news, you know, about federal highway dollars or lack thereof.
The trust fund's broke.
Yeah. Welcome.
Hesker, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. I'm Travis Brower, ODOT's Federal Affairs Advisor, and I'm here to talk to you about the fiscal situation of the Federal Highway Trust Fund, specifically the highway account, which annually provides about $500 million in funding for highway, bridge, bicycle, pedestrian, and a few transit projects across the state. I came and spoke to the House Transportation Committee last year during the interim session and provided an overview of the fiscal situation of the trust fund. And now this is an update on that update as things have actually deteriorated a bit in the last few months. I do come with one good piece of news that I'll get to at the end of the presentation that just broke within the last few minutes. So. Last Friday, ODOT and other state departments of transportation were informed by the U.S. Department of Transportation that the federal government, as of this week, would begin delaying reimbursements to states for federally funded highway projects because the highway account of the Highway Trust Fund had exhausted or will exhaust its balances later this month, and incoming revenue will not be sufficient to meet expenses. Fortunately, we do not anticipate at ODOT that this will require any impacts to projects, any cutting of projects, any delaying of projects in the near term. That is saying essentially that we have the resources to cover the IOUs that the federal government will be issuing. They will be delaying payment but making payment in full as resources come available. So there will essentially be a rolling and gradually increasing IOU from the federal government to the state of Oregon. yet our resources are adequate to cover those IOUs, assuming that Congress acts within the next few months. Beyond that, we just don't know what the impact will be at the federal level, but even beyond that period, we believe that we would have the resources to avoid any impacts to transportation projects. So the question that has come up is how we got here. The highway accounts outlays have been significantly higher than the revenues over the last nearly a decade, primarily because the federal gas tax has not been raised since 1993, and spending has been thus higher than the receipts that have been coming in. When Congress passed the last Surface Transportation Act, which is known as Safety Lou, in 2005, they expected that they'd be able to get through the end of that bill, which expires on September 30th, 2009, and then in federal fiscal year 2010, they would have to face a highway trust fund without any balances. However, the fiscal situation of the highway account has gradually deteriorated, and by sometime last year, they expected that the highway account would run out of resources before Safety Route expired. Within the last 6 months or so, with the incredibly high gas prices we've been facing, the reduction in driving and the move toward more fuel-efficient vehicles has had a substantial impact on the amount of gas tax revenue coming into the highway account. And so we saw a situation, or the date of that day of reckoning moved forward substantially. So while we thought we were going to be able to make it into sometime early next year, say January or February, now the highway account will run out of money within the next couple of weeks. And without those balances to draw on, the incoming revenue will not be adequate to meet the demands, the expenses submitted by states under the Federal Highway Program. So the other question that has come up is how this can be addressed. The U.S. House of Representatives took up and passed legislation with only 37 no votes that would transfer $8 billion back from the general fund to the Highway Trust Fund. This essentially repays the Highway Trust Fund for revenue that it transferred to the general fund in 1998. So it's a very legitimate transfer of resources that were originally part of the Highway Trust Fund. The U.S. Department of Transportation and President Bush and transportation groups have announced their support for this legislation and are calling on the United States Senate to take action on this in the very near future, particularly because the Senate is expected to recess at the end of this month, and it's likely that Congress will not come back into session until potentially after the inauguration in January. The good news that I alluded to earlier is I just got an email indicating that it appears the United States Senate is actually considering this legislation even as I speak, that a deal has been cut to cut through some procedural roadblocks. There will be a vote on it very soon, we hope, and fingers crossed that it will pass, and then due to one minor change, go back to the House of Representatives and get passed into law and signed by the President, who had previously threatened to veto it, but now has indicated he will sign the legislation. So that will transfer in $8 billion that will cover the deficit that the Highway Trust Fund, the highway account, would otherwise face in this coming federal fiscal year. However, it will not deal with similarly sized deficits that the highway program will face in future fiscal years, in federal fiscal year 2010 and beyond. And I would note that while the mass transit account, which is the other side of the highway trust fund, currently has balances still remaining, its balances are expected to be exhausted sometime probably in 2010 or early 2011, and its long-term financial shortfall is actually larger as a portion of overall federal spending on transit. So we're seeing a situation in which both the highway program and the transit program at the federal level are facing severe financial strains, and Congress will need to take action in the next Congress either to substantially cut spending on these two programs or to provide additional revenue that would allow continued support from the federal level at current or higher levels. So with that, I'll wrap up my presentation and allow time for any questions.
Thank you, Brad. Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Charles, I'm glad you had a little bit of good news, because I tell you, you depressed the hell out of me. just to be very clear on which segment that ODOT will be able to cover. So projects that are currently in construction, that I understand they'll move forward. Projects are in planning phases, that there'll be no delay needed to plan and move forward on the projects that we have ongoing. Is that correct?
Chair Metzger, Chair Beyer, Representative Buckley, that is correct. We do not anticipate that this will have any impact on projects that are currently under construction or currently programmed for next year. And future impacts will really depend on what the federal funding is in future years after this next fiscal year is completed and Congress takes up the next Surface Transportation Authorization Act.
Mr. Chair. So projects, for instance, that would be have a start day for construction 2010-2011, those ones are questionable right now. We just have to wait and see what's going to happen.
Representative Buckley, the impact of this will have no impact on those particular projects further out, and it really is a matter of what the state and federal cash flow is like. But we, in putting together our transportation funding program, the STIP, have used fairly conservative estimates of the federal funding that will come in those years. So we have not anticipated a significant increase in federal funding and have not programmed projects based on overly optimistic scenarios.
Thank you, Steve.
Yes, and just think how much better off we'd be if the gas tax holiday had passed like one of the presidential candidates suggested.
Two of them that you suggested. As I recall.
Well, one of the two that's still in there.
Anybody else have any questions?
Okay. Thank you for getting the update. And
thank you.
Let's keep our fingers crossed that that good news actually materializes. You know, one thing, too, we're set to conclude here, and I'll close the Senate and have Chairwoman Beyer close the House, is in terms of transportation funding packages for the next session, I think it's important to think about not only being multimodal, but, and I know that the governor's committees and Representative Beyer's wants to spend a lot of time on that and certainly aware of this, but with the need that is so great, it's going to take a significant amount of revenue if we're actually going to deliver to the people what we're telling we're going to deliver. You know, and you know, putting together a small package, you know, would only create more cynicism by the public, because we wouldn't be able to actually deliver much of anything with that. And if we're going to maintain and build the commerce of the state, we have to be competitive, just like all the other things we talked about. And you know, our sources of revenue for current time in this, you know, this day and age are limited. To do that. But one thing, and I think those of us on transportation are going to have a very serious conversation, both in the House and the Senate, with our colleagues, is to recognize if this is an important ingredient to the economic engine of our state, which it is, and it's that economic engine that pays the income taxes that then goes into schools and health care and everything else, is even though we're in, a declining budget situation, it's the investment that makes the budget grow. And it's part of it, I think, is incumbent on us to explain that to some people who don't understand that if you don't invest in things that make people bring jobs in and put paychecks out, we have no money for schools or health care. And what I'm getting to is that I think especially when we talk about the possibility of another Connect Oregon 3 type of issue, or even with modernization of our highway system, as the Senate member on the Debt Policy Advisory Committee, I've got to tell you that my feeling is that we have to be more restrained in looking at bonding 30 years of debt every year and absorbing money in debt service. At some point, we don't put any general, but the only general fund that we have for transportation is the lawnmower fund, if you remember that, you know, and we've tried to move that into other things, you know. I mean, it's... we don't make a general fund commitment, and I think it's really, really important that we have a conversation that we may want to supplement some of our existing user fees for transportation with real general fund. And yes, that means, you know, the OEA and everybody else is going to be there arguing. But if it can generate the jobs that pays
the income that then pays the money so we can pay for our schools. I just think it's something, because we can't sit borrow the future all the time and say, oh, it's just lottery bonding dollars, because those dollars are tied up. And they're getting smaller all the time, and we're getting initiatives to use more of the restricting the use of the lottery, and we can't just have it for debt. I think we're going to have to put some real dollars in as part of our conversation, and not just look at how we can leverage the future. We see what happens when the federal government leverages the future too much. So that's just a little commentary that you know, that our infrastructure is way behind. And both Senator McCain and Senator Obama have made that very clear, that infrastructure on a federal level is critical to the not only the security of the country, but the economic security. I think on a state level, we need to look at that, too. And we're doing that in some levels, but it isn't just by letting someone else pay for it. We're going to have to pay for some of it up front. So that's mine. I'm going to adjourn the Senate committee, Representative Beyer, and thank you for coming
today.
The House
is adjourned, and thank you for all being here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.